Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Life without a surface and galactic evolution. You're listening to Are We There Yet, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. In the search for life outside our planet, scientists are looking to planets that may be similar to Earth, except they may be water worlds. But can a planet without a solid surface support life? We'll speak with MIT's Sarah Seeger about these strange exoplanets and the chance of alien life. Then, we may not know the universe like we think we do. We'll speak with FIT's Eric Perlman about new findings from the Webb Space Telescope that raises questions about what we know about our universe's timeline. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? Sub-Neptune-sized planets are some of the most common and easiest to study. The Webb Space Telescope recently discovered a planet of this kind that appears to have organic molecules like methane and carbon dioxide. However, they don't have a solid surface, something we'd assume necessary for life to develop. Can life really exist in a surfaceless world? Here to talk about those prospects is Sarah Seeger, a professor and a researcher at MIT. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me today.
So, in this paper, you talk about sub-Neptune planets, and they're some of the most common in our galaxy. But let's take a step back and just explain what a sub-Neptune planet actually is.
Right. Well, actually, we're not sure what exactly it is. We only call it a sub-Neptune because the planets in this category are smaller than Neptune. It doesn't sound like rocket science. It's just kind of where we're at. So in exoplanets, it's amazing, but planets appear to come in all sizes and masses. And as you just said, there's this extremely intriguing class of planets that are smaller than Neptune. So we call them sub-Neptune size, but they're larger than Earth. And they appear to be the most common planets in our galaxy, but we don't know yet what they're made of.
That's got to be fascinating to a planetary scientist like yourself, right? What are these things that are so frequently showing up in, you know, in your observations, right?
Right, right.
So we know they're quite common, at least in what we're seeing now, and they're relatively easy to study. But let's take a step back. When you're searching for life in the universe and utilizing these telescopes looking at exoplanets, what are you actually looking for?
Well, we're looking for two things. And one of them is a bit conservative and terracentric, but we're trying to find planets that have water oceans, liquid water. All of our life here on Earth needs liquid water. And although we can't see liquid water directly on an exoplanet, we can get some other clues, one of them being water vapor in the atmosphere. On a small planet, water vapor would be destroyed by ultraviolet radiation, separated into hydrogen and oxygen. The hydrogen, being a very light gas, would float away and leave the planet, and the oxygen would stay there reacting with other things. But if there is water vapor on a small planet, it has to be continually produced, and the best thing to produce that would be a liquid water ocean.
Why is that so important, to look for that liquid water?
Well, we're trying to find a planet that could host life, or that might have signs of life, and all life needs, we sort of have expanded our definition of what life requires now to any liquid. A liquid solvent where molecules can go and, you know, dissolve. You know, it's like when you put, if you put sugar in your coffee, that sugar, you know, dissolves into the coffee. We need a solvent where molecules can dissolve and react with each other and form new molecules. So water is a very abundant liquid in planets and planetary systems, and we're looking for water vapor. These sub-Neptunes, though, we did put this idea forward a while back that they could have oceans like beneath their surface. I mean, these planets might defy our understanding. You know, we think some of these sub-Neptunes might be water worlds, like 50% or more water by mass, like a scaled up version of one of Jupiter's icy moons. And there's sort of some arguments to say some of them might have water, and it could be like liquid water. It could be a weird hot form of water, like supercritical water. There's all kinds of possibilities.
And that would be incredibly exciting for someone who is looking for a planet that could possibly have these components for life, right? I mean, that would be a huge find.
Right. And just to sort of lay all the cards on the table, rocky planets like Earth you know, that would have rocks, a crust, and then oceans on top and maybe continents. Those are our number one planet we want to study, but they're just like a tiny bit out of reach right now. We're trying to study them. But these sub-Neptunes, they're bigger than Earth and they're easier to study.
But still, I mean, what's baffling to me, and we talked about this before, Sarah, is that you are looking at planets that exist outside of our solar system. I mean, how do you spot tiny molecules of hydrogen, oxygen, water at such great distances, and in what is an infinitesimal speck in our night sky when we look at it here from Earth?
It's really amazing we can do this at all. And with the new James Webb Space Telescope, our data is amazing. And how we do this is there's a special set of planets that go in front of their star as seen from our viewpoint. We call them transiting planets. And they're special because the planets can have all kinds of orbits. Like if the planet is orbiting in what we call the plane of the sky, it never goes in front of the star. Some of them are just lined up just so. Think of like a Frisbee or like a pizza, you know, just lined up in front of your eyes. And the planet is orbiting in a plane where it goes in front of the star. Well, when the planet goes in front of the star, some of the starlight shines through the atmosphere, and we can literally see some of the atmospheric features of the planet imprinted on the star. So we can look at the star by itself, and we can look at the star when the planet's in front of it and compare those, and we can try to tease out what is in the planet atmosphere.
It's incredible every time a planetary scientist like yourself explains it. It's just crazy. Let's go back to you're talking about looking at these sub-Neptune planets. They're larger than an Earth-sized planet, so you're able to look at them, but they may defy our expectations of what this planet is made of. Let's talk about what the expectations of what life could be on these planets. We're talking about a water world. What would life look like on a planet like this? And I know that this is kind of speculative at this time, but what would it look like?
Well, we really don't know. I mean, that definitely is speculation. If we only had oceans and no land here, what would happen, right? Like, we probably wouldn't be here. We love how, like, dolphins are so beautiful and intelligent, you know, fish, microbes. We're really working hard to expand and go beyond our very narrow viewpoints here on our planet Earth, you know, using our Earth. And one of the ideas I wrote about was, imagine if we do have a mini Neptune or sub-Neptune, but it's hot because atmospheres of planets are like a giant blanket, you know, like we call it the greenhouse effect, and they trap heat. And a lot of these sub-Neptunes that we can discover today, they're just kind of too warm, like their water oceans could be too hot. So one of the things I'd like to imagine was life in the clouds, like a totally cloud-based life system that's just bacteria. Here on our planet Earth, we have life in our clouds. Bacteria gets swept up from the surface, it gets inside the cloud droplets. You know, it can be stay up there for about a week and it can be transported across continents. That'd be bad, right? I mean, if it doesn't want to be transported, it's a long way to go. And then it gets rained out. But we might imagine some planets could have a, you know, like a aerial biosphere that's persistent, that's permanently there.
Aerial biosphere. That sounds incredibly interesting. What did you base this paper on? You know, I'm assuming you're not able to see this at this time. So, you know, how are you thinking about this aerial biosphere on a planet outside of our solar system?
Well, believe it or not, this idea dates back half a century. And I tried to sort of dig out what was going on back then, but Carl Sagan and others, they wanted to expand our ideas of habitability. And they talked about life in the clouds of Jupiter, and they had all these ideas. Some seem pretty extreme right now, like active life that would self-inflate to like stay aloft. The problem with Jupiter is that it's really hot. I mean, we think of Jupiter as being freezing cold because it's so far away from the sun, but it has a lot of leftover heat on the inside since it formed. And that heat is slowly, slowly leaking out. Like, you know how if your power goes out on a cold day, your house does get cold, but not right away. And for Jupiter, it takes billions of years for all its heat to leak out. So beneath the atmosphere, it's really hot, too hot for life. So if there was life in the clouds of Jupiter, you know, it would basically eventually these convective cells would bring it down to where it would just get destroyed. So Jupiter's not a great place. They also wrote about the possibility of an aerial biosphere, life in the clouds on Venus. Now on Venus, the surface is too hot for life of any kind. But just like here on Earth, when you hike up a mountain, it gets colder and colder, so too on Venus. And in the cloud layer of Venus, it's just the right temperature for life. But back then, they didn't know what the Venus clouds were made of. They're not made of water, they're made of another liquid called sulfuric acid. But suffice to say, just this idea that there could be life in the clouds, we have life in our clouds on Earth, people have thought about it for other planets. It was time to take that idea and look at it in the context of the new planets we know about.
I may be connecting the wrong dots here, Professor, but you know, I know that there is a lot of attention to what's going on in the clouds of Venus when it comes to certain signatures that have been found. And, you know, there's calls to send probes to Venus in the coming years. Will what we learn going forward in, you know, the clouds of Venus kind of help you solidify your ideas for what these aerial biospheres would be on exoplanets?
Very much so. And I actually work on Venus. It's actually probably my main line of research right now, actually. One thing we did on Venus was we did have to ask ourselves, if there is life in the Venus clouds, how does it sail off forever? It's just like that story on Jupiter. The surface is very, very hot. But one intriguing thing about the Venus atmosphere is that it doesn't have those giant convective cells that Jupiter has. In fact, right below the clouds, it's really stagnant. We have measurements from probes from the former Soviet Union and from NASA's Pioneer Venus from the 1970s and in some cases early 1980s that actually measured wind speeds, and they found this very stagnant layer. So we imagine that if there is life on Venus, in the cloud particles, the particles collide and grow over time, and eventually they get heavy and start to rain out. Well, in the case of Venus, it wouldn't go to the surface where it's too hot for life, because that cloud liquid would evaporate and it would leave what you could imagine of like a spore. You know, when you see spores from plants and stuff, like a little dried out piece could just, it would stop falling because it would lose all its mass, and now it could be suspended right below the clouds. And I love this idea because, you know what? Beneath the clouds of Venus, there's a haze layer composed of hazes that we don't know what it is, what they are made of. And you could imagine it just being peppered with these little spores just sort of hanging out until they get brought back up, where they could act like a cloud condensation nuclei and reform and start the life over again. So what we did learn from studying Venus was you could imagine life persisting aloft because it sort of rains out, evaporates, and just kind of stalls out. But that won't happen on planets with very vigorous atmospheres because they're going to get killed by two hot layers. So on these sub-Neptunes, the key here, you can only have the cloud if when these convective cells bring them back down, it's not too hot at those lower layers. Otherwise, the life will just be cooked.
And finally, what is the most exciting prospect for the future of looking at these, you know, sub-Neptune exoplanets? Will we get to a point where we'll have as much data as we get are getting from, you know, our solar system planets? What does the future look like for studying these really interesting and curious worlds?
Well, they're definitely interesting and curious. And right now, we're kind of at the stage, like if you're cleaning out your closet, you take everything out and it's a giant mess. We're at that stage before we've put it all back together. We do have new observations of our iconic sub-Neptune. It's called K2-18b. These new observations are at the James Webb Space Telescope. And they show a lot of methane in the atmosphere, but they're not showing water vapor. They hasn't found any water vapor, contradicting earlier work by the Hubble Space Telescope showing that there was water vapor. Now, if there's no water vapor, there can still be a water ocean by various arguments, but the whole thing's a bit tangled right now. Now, we won't have the same kind of data we get on our solar system planets, unfortunately, because here we can send missions to solar system planets. We can measure their shape and their gravity, which helps us understand how the layers are distributed on the inside. So we won't have that same level of data. We're expecting to be able to piece together what the planets are made of. And, you know, they're not all going to be water worlds or all rocks with a giant hydrogen helium envelope, because nature, I like to say or think, is more clever than we are and is more broad. So we're hoping to be able to identify what these planets are made of by their atmospheres. And that's where we're at right now.
And an exciting time to be at. So Professor Seeger, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
Still to come, galactic evolution, how new findings from the Webb Space Telescope are changing our understanding of the universe's timeline. That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. In the past year, the Webb Space Telescope has been making new discoveries at an incredible rate, and the trend continues. A new observation seems to raise questions on our understanding of the evolution of galaxies and our understanding of the universe. Well, here to break down these findings is Eric Perlman, professor of physics and space sciences at Florida Tech. Professor Perlman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Brendan.
Glad to have you. And whenever there's something exciting about JWST, we have to call you. And there's quite a bit of exciting things happening with the findings coming from the space-based telescope. First is some new findings regarding the evolution of galaxies. What do we know about our galactic evolution and how we got here?
So we know that the Big Bang happened. We know that one of the things that happened in the Big Bang was nucleosynthesis. So there was an initial period where basically these fundamental particles did a little bit of fusion, and what they produced was hydrogen and helium and basically nothing else. They didn't get any further. So anything that is heavier than hydrogen and helium that we find in galaxies has to have been made in stars, and you know that indicates evolution. So that is what we know. And what we know also is that, so JWST is seeing galaxies as far back as roughly 400 million years after the Big Bang. What we're seeing in those is that somehow there are too many heavy elements. So there's too much carbon, there's too much oxygen, there's too much nitrogen and silicon and things like that. And to get those things, you have to have had at least one or two generations of stars that existed. Because if you have stars that only have hydrogen and helium, you're only going to see hydrogen and helium lines. So the fact that you see this much carbon and nitrogen and oxygen means that the stars in them have to be at least a certain age and that they have had at least a couple of generations of previous star formation.
You said something that JWST is able to see 400 million years after the Big Bang. Big Bang is what, 13 billion years ago? That seems like a very, very long time into our cosmic past. How is it doing that?
So two things. So first of all, it's really, really sensitive. Okay, and so these galaxies are extremely faint. And it's also doing that because it's going into the infrared. JWST is not just a successor to Hubble. JWST works in the infrared, whereas Hubble worked in the optical and a little bit of the near infrared. And so let's take a galaxy that we're seeing, say, 400 million years after the Big Bang. Well, the problem with seeing a galaxy like that is that if we want to look at light that would be in the optical in that galaxy, it's not in the optical for us. It is actually much further into the infrared, okay? So it would be at a wavelength of something like 6 microns to us. And so we actually have to look into the infrared to actually see the light from those galaxies, and also to see any spectral lines that cause us to get these kinds of results. So that's the other thing about JWST, the fact that it works in the infrared and the fact that it's in this ridiculously low background location at L2. I mean, those are things that make it just a unique, not only successor, but completely new telescope.
So with that ability, this sensitivity and the ability to see in the infrared and in these wavelengths, you're saying that the observations are picking up too many heavy metals. What does that mean? Does that upend what we think happened? Or is it that the universe is older than we think it is?
I don't think it's older than we think it is, because the model that we have for the universe, that age does not depend on these data. But what it does mean probably is that something happened in the early history for these galaxies and the early evolution of these galaxies that is different than what our models say. Our models say that there is a first generation of stars and that we should be looking at that first generation of stars. But what this data is telling us is that there had to have been at least one generation of stars before these stars that we are seeing. And so the question is, how did that happen? If you can find out a way for there to be a complete other generation of stars before, you know, then you're okay. Because if you put that into the model, that fixes the discrepancy. The way that this has to work, though, is that, first of all, this very first generation of star formation, it had to happen very early, number one. Number two, what this is telling us is that it had to contain a much larger number of really massive stars than the stars that we see now. What we see now is star formation that mostly produces low-mass stars, and that the number of stars per unit mass goes down as the stellar mass goes up, okay? And it goes down pretty steeply. But what this is saying is that a whole lot of that early generation of stars had to be very high mass, at least 20 to 50 times the sun's mass. And the reason why it's saying that is because they had to go supernova, and they had to explode and spread their matter, which was enriched with all of the fusion that would have gone on in these stars, into interstellar space. And then another generation of stars formed after that. That's what it's saying. And that is not an easy thing to do. The problem is that, okay, you can put this in by hand, but putting something in by hand into a model is one of the most unsatisfying and really dishonest things that you can do as a scientist. Because really, you want a theory that can actually say, well, this happened because of this. This is what the model predicts. It should do this next. And you shouldn't have a large number of, you know, these things that you put in by hand. You shouldn't have all of these free parameters. When you tweak something and you keep tweaking it, that's a problem.
Will we get to a point where we'll make observations farther back than this that might help fill in those gaps? Or have we reached kind of the top level of what JWST is able to do?
So we have not yet reached the top level of what JWST is able to do.
Seriously?
No, we have not. We have not.
That's crazy.
For two reasons. Number one, what we are looking at now. So JWST has been up for a little under 2 years. What happens in the first year of a mission? And we really are talking about the first year, because remember, checkout took 6 months, right? And everything was online beginning in about June, right? So that's June 22. And here we are, it's the beginning of October 2023. So we're talking really 15 months of full operation of JWST, and also a few months of checkout operations, right? What happens in the first year of any telescope is, number one, there's a whole lot of seeing what it can do. And some of the really deep stuff, some of the really hard stuff gets saved till year two, year three, year four. If you remember, the Hubble Ultra Deep Field and each of the other fields, those didn't come around. The first Hubble Deep Field was 1995, 1996, right? And it kept getting deeper each time they did a new one. And the last of them was in the 2010s, right? Now, the same thing, the same kind of thing is going to happen with JWST. So that's the first reason that we haven't seen the best of JWST. It's because these deep images that we're seeing, I promise you, if we come back 2-3 years from now, there is going to be a set of images that is much deeper than this. So what we're seeing now is spectroscopy that's being done in the near infrared. Well, let's go to longer wavelengths. When we go to fainter and fainter images, deeper and deeper images, we're going to discover fainter and fainter galaxies. And some of those fainter and fainter galaxies are going to be at higher redshift, which means even earlier, even further back in the universe. And so we're going to need to not only have more observation time to study them, but we're also going to have to take the spectra not in the near infrared, but in the mid infrared, We can do that with JWST. There are three instruments on JWST, and one of them is MIRI, which is a mid-infrared instrument, and you can take spectra with that. But we're not seeing those results yet because they haven't happened.
That is like so cool to even think about. Professor Perlman, there's also, even before we get to those findings, there have been some other findings on JWST that have excited you, including one at the Orion Nebula Cluster. What is so exciting about this particular observation?
The Orion Nebula Cluster is the nearest large star formation region in our galaxy. With JWST, they took this huge survey of that region, 700 images, and they pasted them together. And they were looking for a whole lot of we didn't know what, because you don't know what you're going to find. You just know you're going to find something interesting, right? And so this is work that only JWST can do because it's the first telescope this sensitive in the infrared, and it's looking at this fantastic region. So what did it find? A whole lot of things that we don't know yet, but this particular result is that it found these interesting objects. They're very faint, they're Jupiter-sized, apparently, and they're in binaries, and they're not connected with any star. They're freely floating in space. So first of all, how did they get there, right? We think that the way that you form planets and the way that you form stars are one and the same. In other words, the only way that you get planets is if you have them forming along with a star. So a star forms, and while the star is forming, the gas around the star is settling down into a disk, and then the material in that disk begins to stick together, and then gravity takes over, and planets begin to form. Well, that's great, except you have these planets that are not in star systems, right? They're freely floating in space, and they're Jupiter-sized. They're not small, right? They're big. And then they're in binaries. That's the second thing. How did that happen? And by the way, another reason why this is so puzzling is it turns out that there really is no other way, we think, to form planets, because if you try to form Jupiter mass planets just out of gas, it takes too long for them to form. In fact, would be longer than the age of the Orion cluster. We know how old the Orion cluster is. So there really is no other way to get these, but we see them. And by the way, I don't know the answer to that question.
I was going to say, it seems like with JWST, we're getting more questions than answers, but that's a good thing when it comes to science, right?
You know, that's exactly what we were hoping for. It's one of those things that really makes you scratch your head, because as one of my colleagues, Mark McCaughran, said about these objects, this is something that seems to break physics as we know it.
Well, if physics is going to break, I'm glad we have someone like you to explain what's happening. Eric Perlman is a professor of physics and space science at Florida Tech. Always great to have you on the show, Professor.
Great to be here. Thanks.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit wmfe.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Our intern is Alessandro Boniuto. Editorial guidance from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.